We're broadcasting now a short story called Five Albatrosses, A Great Elk and A Grave in Glasnevin. It's written and narrated by Basil Payne.
Boats, my 19-year-old son accuses me, meaning opportunities missed by me. Perversely, he tells me, almost on purpose, he suspects. The world's champion boat misser. I've caught a few boats, I remind him, real ones, not metaphors. The Canberra, the France, the QE2, Poe's and artist afloat, performing my works and pumps for passenger consumption. Yes, I've caught quite a few boats. And I saw five albatrosses once, on the Pacific, circling in slow, beautiful formation, 20 feet above the boat deck, for 2 hours almost, cleaving the air with their great wings. Five albatrosses, five. I wish my father had been there. He spent his whole life dreaming of seeing an albatross, but all he saw was seagulls. On his single sea crossing with my mother to the Isle of Man and back, only seagulls. And he could see these any day over the River Liffey or Sandymount Strand or the Bull Wall or Hoath Head or even Glasnevin Cemetery. But an albatross was what he always wanted to see. He knew Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner off by heart, all 142 stanzas, starting with the first quatrain, "It is an ancient mariner, and he stopped one of three, by thy long grey beard and glittering eye, now wherefore stoppest thou me?" I am still haunted by that long grey beard and glittering eye, and by the albatross, bird of good omen, 40 years after my father embedded their images in my memory. He'd recite whole sections of the poems to us regularly, in the kitchen, at evening, his blue, faraway eyes clear as coral pools. Other times he'd sing some of his favourite songs, "Like a Golden Dream," "When Other Lips," "Just a Song at Twilight," and then his grand finale, "Many Brave Hearts." "Many brave hearts are asleep in the deep, so beware, beware." Sailor, we all called him, since I was about 4 years old. The summer he and my mother came back from their week's holiday in the Isle of Man. Father was wearing a navy blue seaman's cap, exactly like the one on the packets of Player's Navy Cut cigarettes, which he smoked all his life, 3 packs a day, en route to his first coronary. Mother kept telling him to take off that ridiculous cap, that he was making a laughing stock of himself in front of the neighbours. Why couldn't he be his age? Last month it was trick riding down the street in his racing bicycle, standing on the saddle with his hands in the air and a silly look on his face, and now acting the fool again in this ridiculous cap. But Father simply laughed and sang Popeye the Sailor Man, a juvenile schoolyard version that he'd heard some young Dubliner singing on the ferry. He wore the cap indoors and outdoors for the next month, maybe to defy Mother, maybe to cover up his too-soon balding head, maybe because he simply liked it. It was at that time we started to call him Sailor, and the name stuck, right till the day he died. Michael was his real name, after the Archangel, an angel with clipped wings and a sailor's cap. Sailor the boat misser, my precursor, maybe. My son wants me to tell him more about my father, even a few anecdotes. "How come," he says, "you never spoke to me about him till now? How come you never even visit his grave?" I promise him that when the time is right, I will tell him more about my father. Today, 4 months after my son's request, the time seems right, because yesterday I visited my father's grave. For the first time since I watched the brass-plated oak coffin containing what is euphemistically called his mortal remains, being lowered into the lumpy clay in Glasnevin Cemetery, one wet winter's morning 32 years ago. Now that my memory is loosened, now that my heart is opened, what memories of my father shall I pen for my son? What can I tell him that will reveal Father, simply, openly, truthfully? My real father, not the born loser that my uncles labelled him. Father, a small, mild-tempered man with few apparent ambitions, few apparent regrets, retired prematurely from his limousine business because of recession and an early coronary. Bald, bespectacled, self-effacing, Fond of strong tea, grilled kippers, gingerbread, whist drive, cycling, gramophone records, operatic and music hall. Sitting by the fire or by the window, smoking, reading the evening paper, saying little. A born loser, mother's relatives labelled him, and I was too young to question the glib evaluation, too young to know my real father, till it was too late to manifest the love we all denied him when he was alive, by making mother the shrine of our lives, and father its unremarkable appendage. I promised my son that I'd pen some memories of my father for him to share when the time was right. Now that the time is right, and scores of memories resurface, which shall I share? Incidents, sad, funny, painful, beautiful. Epiphanies that linger and haunt and sustain. Epiphanies that reveal that father was a poet, in the true sense of the word. Not someone who wrote poetry, but a man whose whole commitment in life was to keep searching, to keep trusting, to keep loving, to keep accepting, to keep faith with himself and the world, to get in touch with that beyond himself, to be a person without walls, a man who lived his heart out, knowing that time resolves all, redeems all, recovers all. One epiphany suffices, at the National Museum, to see the great Irish elk, when I was 8 years old. Father held me by the hand almost all afternoon, not possessively, not restrainingly, simply with total love. I mention it with heartache and with gratitude approaching veneration, because in all my years of childhood I had never been touched so gently and firmly. But back to the great Irish elk, skeletoned, massive, magnificent, cutting bored navy-suited attendants and bored Sunday visitors down to size, except for the children, eager-eyed, ready to merge with the mystery. I stared and stared. "That's it," Father said, still holding my hand. "The great Irish elk, extinct but still around, after 12,000 years, defying time and place. Take a good look at those giant antlers, and remember us, me and you." The last six words were only a faintly audible addendum, but he did speak them, as an archangel might speak, or an albatross, if an albatross could talk. I suspect it can, a language of supreme generosity that might transfigure us if we could hear it. "Yes, Father, I looked. I am still looking, looking backwards and forwards in time, clearly and clairvoyantly, because now I perceive. The great Irish elk, the great loser, the great winner, the great Zen master, stripped of power and pretense, into final selfhood, final endurance, into touch with that beyond itself, close to the mystery at the heart of time, the central mystery that can only be hinted at. Yesterday I visited my father's grave in Glasnevin Cemetery. The white marble tombstone with its black indented letters gleamed in the August sunshine. "In loving memory, Michael, devoted husband, father, I am the resurrection and the life." I touched the slightly warm tombstone, touched the slightly warm clay, gently, humbly, gratefully. Then I left, light-hearted, light-footed, free, in touch at last with that beyond myself. A poet almost, like my father. A final word about the great Irish elk. There was no such creature. So I am definitively informed by a manual of extinct terrestrial mammals of Ireland in the National Museum. I quote, "the giant deer, Megacheros giganteus." Because of the similarity in appearance of the antlers of the giant Irish deer to those of the elk, moose and fallow deer, it has, in the past, been erroneously referred to as the great Irish elk. So much for the murderous machinery of words. But they can't impinge on epiphany. The giant Irish deer is the great Irish elk which father and I stared at so long ago. If anything, I suspect, those antlers will have grown perceptibly, maybe a sacred millimetre. I had thought of revisiting the museum as a last tribute to father, to tell him I am still looking, still cherishing our shared epiphany, The moment out of time that can't be obliterated, ever. Yes, I had thought of going back some Sunday afternoon to re-savor all that's lost and all that can never be lost. But I've decided against going. I could never face those printed notices saying, "Please do not touch." Do not touch. The injunction of our times. One human touch can challenge the past and its incertitudes. One human touch can quiver us to a new identity. One human touch can threaten all the cherished instability of forced bravura in the face of our own and everyone else's vulnerability. Better to talk than to touch. Talk is what we do to one another. There's only one problem. Talk can never undo talk's inflictions, or sorrows, or scars. But touch can, and touch does. No, I won't go back to the National Museum to gaze at the great Irish elk, alias giant Irish deer, or at the printed notices saying, "Please do not touch." Instead, I'll go upstairs now, right away, to the guest bedroom, where my son sleeps when he stays here, and I'll feast my eyes and my fingertips on the silky, smooth, bark-stripped, 4-foot-long driftwood tree branch, which he reclaimed from the sea at Killiney Beach 2 years ago. He has left it lying outside the white candlewick coverlet on his divan bed, for anyone who visits to share. On the beautiful bark-stripped glossy surface, he has inscribed in bright acrylic blues, reds, greens, yellows, the following invitation. Touch, feel, caress. I am dead, but given life by your perception. Some of our overnight visitors find this beautiful. Those who reach out. Others, afraid of the merge, smile in discreet bafflement and say nothing. But the splendid transfigured driftwood branch, like the great Irish elk's magnificent antlers, will endure, transcending, in time that cannot be timed, man's fear of commitment, man's fear of beauty, man's fear of the merge.
That short story was written and narrated by Basil Payne. The producer was Maxwell Sweeney. And next Sunday's story is called The Ballad of the Hard Road by Maura Tracy.